History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as some of us are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then invest a little time to patiently listen as memories from long ago make their way back to the surface in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This coming Wednesday, December 7th, is, of course, Pearl Harbor Day. Now, 81 years since that date, which has indeed lived in infamy, as President Franklin D. Roosevelt said. We have met dozens of Pearl Harbor survivors on Hometown Heroes over the years, but the reality is most of them are no longer with us. Their stories live on, and you can explore all of them at hometownheroesradio.com. But today, we're going to hear from three Pearl Harbor survivors who are still with us. We're going to start with Bill Pratt. He'll celebrate his 101st birthday in a couple weeks in Fresno, California. He grew up in Illinois, Kentucky, and Oklahoma, but he and his older brother Basil were on the battleship USS Nevada on December 7th, 1941.
My battle station was in the Chantilly. That was down in the bottom of the ship where the main engine, we had two main engine rooms, and the main engine drive shaft that went from the engine back to the propeller, where it moved back to the outside the ship, and that was housed in a certain compartment in there. That was a battle station for somebody, usually two men. It was two compartments. You had to just make sure that, well, the main shaft from the engine to the propeller went through this compartment and out of the ship, and you had to make sure that the struts of the bearings were getting oiled, and for leaks and stuff like that. And I was in the starboard engine room. My brother was over in the port engine room, but that's where we served, down the engine room. They attacked us at 8 o'clock in the morning at Pearl Harbor. That was Sunday morning. They were raising a flag all over the harbor and on those different ships, and you could hear they would play a bugle, or if they had a band, they'd play the Star Spangled Banner when they raised the flag in the morning, because it was in port. We raised the flag every morning, and we struck it every night. It didn't fly at night, and there was a procedure for that. Of course, if you were at sea, the flag flew on the main mast all the time, night and day. About halfway up was the place for it. But raising and the lowering of the flag was an event that I remember, because that's something you done every day. It was important.
So were you topside for that?
Yeah, sometimes if I was involved in raising or the flag, there was a detail that marched the flag back and put it on the pole and raise it at sunrise every morning, and at sunset at night, we would go back and get it.
And what about that Sunday morning? Were you up top for that, or were you down below?
It was Sunday morning. I didn't have anything to do. I was just laying around in the quarters. Of course, I began to hear bombs going off, but I didn't know there were bombs. And when I hit our ship, and then it shook it, and I started to go up on topside and see what was going on when general quarters sounded. So I had to go down the engine room. I had my battle station was back in the shaft alley. It was scary for me because I was down there by myself. Then the lights went out. We got generators got hit, and the power was off for a while. The lights went out everywhere on the ship, but I was back in a shaft alley by myself. It was dark, and it was scary because I didn't know what was going on. Knew the ship was listed to the port side. We had been hit on the port side. The torpedo planes had got to the port side, and that's what I was noticing. The ship was listed to the port side. We'd already heard that it was the Oklahoma that capsized. The USS Oklahoma was hit on the port side, and they capsized. The thing turned bottom side up. The water in the harbor is shallow. No ships sunk. They didn't go out of sight. You could see part of them. There was a lot of destruction. I didn't see it. I wasn't up on top side to see it. I had to go to my battle station, but we stayed there until we were released. They had the bugle call that went out over the loudspeaker.
Well, let me ask you this first, and we'll get to that. Because most of the Pearl Harbor survivors I've talked to, there was some point, you know, initially most of them thought this was some kind of drill or maneuver, and then there was a point of realization that this is actually an attack. What about you? Was there a time where you didn't know what was happening or you weren't sure?
At the beginning, I heard the planes. The dive bombers were diving on the scene. You could hear the engine laborers that come out of the dive, but planes would practice in peacetime. They would dive on us and just for practice. And I didn't know whether it was that or it was a real thing, but it was a real thing. You could hear them, the planes dive, and when they come out of the dive, they dropped their bomb. Well, the engine would make a laboring noise that you could hear, and I could hear that down the engine room.
So when did it sink in for you that this was the real thing, that you were at war?
Well, I don't know. I went to my battle station. I began to feel the ship getting hit, and it would either shake or it would lift over to one side, or it would do something. When a bomb would hit, you knew it. War was imminent with Japan, and we were expecting it. And it was getting more imminent all the time until it happened.
So you know, general quarter sounds, you go down to that room, and you told us you're all alone, and then the lights go out. You're all alone, the lights go out, and a lot of times in those situations, they dog down those hatches. Were you trapped in there where you were?
Well, I thought I would have been. My battle station was down there in one of these compartments, and the shaft would run through it. And in case the automatic lubrication stop where you're supposed to oil the shaft. Look, report leaks, and just generally be there to report anything. You were dogged in. You wasn't supposed to get out. They had the watertight door closed. I was in the first compartment, and there was a hatch there, but we weren't supposed to open it, and we didn't. It was dog closed. It went to the engine room.
Well, and I bring that up because, you know, we know now what happened with the Nevada on December 7th, and your ship did some things that no other ship in the harbor did, but there were 60 of your shipmates killed and over 100 wounded, and your ship was hit by a bunch of bombs and torpedoes. So if the ship had gone down, you would have had no way of getting out. You would have been trapped in that room, right?
That's right. Of course, Pearl Harbor is shallow. But still, your compartment would have been flooded. The battleships that sunk, they would sink, they'd rest on the bottom. They'd sink down as far as they could go, and the top side would still be above water. But all of the interior compartments would be flooded.
So as this is unfolding, and there's the first wave of the attack, and your ship is hit, and we know that because there wasn't a ship outboard of the Nevada, it was able to get underway and start moving around the harbor a little bit. And so as that's happening, is there something that you have to do at your duty station, or are you just kind of...
When I was in the engine room, my battle station in port is in the starboard engine room, and I run some pumps with it. We pumped all the liquids, water, fuel, whatever was pumped in a steam pump. And those pumps were located in the engine room, down on the lower deck. My station was down there running those pumps, seeing that they were two pumps for every function. If one pump stopped, you're supposed to start the other. But in some cases, you needed both pumps running. That's where I was, in port. That was my battle station. But after the ship got underway, I had to go back to the shaft alley.
So I've just... You know, I'm trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You are a couple weeks shy of your 20th birthday. You're all alone in this room. The lights go out. You feel the ship shaking. But, I mean, are you a little bit scared in that moment? What's going through your mind?
Absolutely. I thought the end had come. And you're sitting there in the darkness by yourself. I really thought it was over. And of course, you do a lot of things. You even pray that you'll get out there. And, well, I could do nothing but sit there and wait because I was in the darkness. I couldn't see what I was doing anyhow. And we didn't know. I didn't know where the water was leaking in the back compartment, but it wasn't. It was leaking into compartments beyond me. The compartment I was in didn't take on any water. But anyhow, we had to stay there. Finally, the lights come back on. They got the generators running. They got the lights back on. They assessed the damage, and they let me out of the shaft alley. They opened the door and called me out. I was glad to get out of there, too.
I was going to say, you said that, you know, when you're alone in the dark and you thought it was the end, that you were praying. And I imagine when the lights came on and they let you out, that probably felt like an answer to prayer.
Yes, but it didn't happen right away. There is some things you can do, and you try to do them, but it's on your battle station. You're not supposed to leave. You're not supposed to open that door. There's a watertight door that goes to the engine room, but you're not supposed to open it. At that time, we were pretty patriotic. We were taught that it was a dishonor to leave your battle station and do something you wasn't supposed to do, and we all done what we were told to do, no matter what. And I never tried to open the door. It had to be opened from the other side because if it was flooded, you'd be flooded too. But anyhow, I didn't, and I waited until I seen they were opening the door. But the guy told me, he says, "We're abandoning the ship. Let's get out of here." I got out of there in a hurry. I followed him up. Me and him were the last two out of the engine room. We had to go up a ladder. It was a metal ladder, a zigzag ladder that took us out of the engine room up to the third deck. And we got out of there, and they closed that hatch. It had a big hatch there, that watertight hatch that you could close. When we got out, they closed that hatch and dogged it down. But I went on up to the top side. But I didn't know what to do. I just done what everybody else did. I stand around, and the deck crews were in charge of the protection of the deck, and they were doing all the shooting and everything. We didn't have guns. We sort of just survived it till the end, till it was over.
Well, and here's, you know, so I understand. Again, what the Nevada did that morning, a lot of people have heard the story. You did get underway, you're navigating the channel. Then there's this fear because your ship's been hit by several more bombs. They say at least 6 bombs hit the ship, maybe as many as 10. But while you're trying to sail out of Pearl Harbor, you're hit by all these bombs. Then they're concerned that you're going to block the channel and trap everyone. So they send your ship over to Hospital Point to run aground. So is that when you came topside, when they'd run aground at Hospital Point?
Yeah, they backed the ship up as far as it'd go at Hospital Point. It was a sandy beach and it was sloping.
And one more thought on that, because, you know, the fear, the reason they ran them aground is that fear they're going to sink and block the channel, given what you've told us about where you were and what the situation was. If the ship had gone down in the channel, guys up top would have been able to abandon ship. You would have been out of luck, right?
Yes.
You wouldn't be here.
Well, that's true, yeah. Yeah.
Just wanted to get that straight. So they run the ship aground, and that's when you're let out of there. They undo the hatch, and you come topside. And you've been hearing all this. You've been feeling when the ship was hit. But when you could see up top, you know, in the open air at Pearl Harbor, what kinds of things did you see?
Well, the ships I could see were sunk at their pier, and they had sunk down as far as they go. The harbor's shallow, and they could sink down to it till they sitting on the bottom top side. The top deck was still above water, and that's what I seen, all these ships sitting there with their top side. They were sunk, but the top side still above water, and the men would they were issued guns, and they'd shoot at everything that moved.
I imagine there's a fair amount of smoke in the air too.
Yeah, yes, it was. It was a confusing mess. You didn't know what to expect if you went to the top side. But that's the way it was. The channel is not that wide coming in and out. And if you blocked the channel, then the ships couldn't go out.
So could you see the Oklahoma upside down and the Arizona still burning and the other ships that had suffered damage?
Yes, could. I had some naval pictures that were taken during the attack.
How hard was that to see? I mean, you'd never seen anything like that before, probably never felt or smelled anything like that before.
No, I hadn't. But, you know, you don't know what to expect until you go up and see it. And most of the ships were sitting on the bottom, but their top deck was out of water. And that's where the men were. They could go up to the main deck and still be above the water.
Were you trying to find your brother?
No.
Not yet.
No. I don't know. You're thinking about other things. And you're thinking about surviving, really. What happened is the Nevada backed up on the beach at Hospital Point and settled on the bottom with her topside above water. And her stern was high and dry because it's almost out of the water.
So where did you go?
Well, I put on top side. And they give me a rifle. They give us a rifle, and we shot at everything that moved because we didn't know whether they were going to invade the islands or not. They usually do after they bomb it good. The landing forces come in and take over, but they didn't.
What kinds of things were you doing for the rest of that Sunday?
Well, we had to wait on that Nevada. We was up on the bow. Of course, we wasn't in danger of the thing sinking. It was always sitting on the bottom until a motor launch come and got us. We had two motor launches on the Nevada, but they could only get to one motor launch. The other one the crane wouldn't bear it over to the water, across the ship. And a lot of men left on that first motor launch that left the ship. But the rest of us had to wait until a boat came and got us. And it took us to Army barracks on the base. They fed us, and they kind of organized the thing so that if they needed men, they would take them from that pool of men that were without a ship, their ship had been sunk, and they'd made it to shore.
There were 60 men from your ship who died that day. Did you know any of those guys?
I'd known of them. I didn't have any close friends that died, but I had known of some of those guys. They were 5th Division. None of my immediate friends died. They were all with me. And they come through it together.
When did you get to see Basil? And what was that like? What'd you guys talk about?
Well, I was taken back to Pearl Harbor. They had barracks there for Army or for when we needed them. And we needed them, so they used them. They opened them up and used those barracks. I stayed there. They fed us and give us a place to sleep for 2 or 3 days. And in that time, Basil found me. He was looking for me, and he found me. He was in that same bunch, too. He was in that same group of men that I was in.
One of the things, you know, again, some of the patterns that I hear from a lot of the people I've talked to who were there, a lot of them say, you know, it was weeks, maybe months before their families knew whether they were alive or dead. What did your parents know about you and your brother?
Well, I wrote a letter as soon as the thing was over, and they encouraged us all to write home. And I did, and let my mother know that Basil and I were okay.
They came through and handed everybody postcards and said, write your family?
Postcard, yeah. They had special postcards that they could handle and take them out and get them delivered pretty easy. I mean fast, not easy, but fast. Get them to a delivery point anyhow.
You know, it's been 80 years, and I know this is something you lived through, and it's become a part of who you are and a part of your story. But, and this is a long time ago to go back to how it felt, but can you help the rest of us understand how shocking that whole situation was or how you received this new reality?
Well, It is just a helpless feeling that you realize you're in a situation you can't do anything about. This thing was coming upon you. And you expect to die. You don't think you're going to get out of it alive because it looks bad at first. That's the kind of situation I was in. It looked very bad at first. But as things developed, it began to look better. And we had assistance from other ships in the fleet and other departments that helped us. I don't know, you just quit worrying, I guess, and go on with the program. Actually, you expect to survive, actually. You teach yourself to expect to survive, and that's what we've done. I'm going to survive this.
One thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story that nobody else could tell us. Here's one more question for you. Is there something that you think, that you say, you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
I appreciated the support that the people at home gave us, I think, more than anything. And I know my mother and father did. I appreciated that. And that's enough to keep you going, just to know that somebody is dependent upon you and you do your best.
Is there something that you think, that you say, you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
I appreciated the support that the people at home gave us, I think, more than anything. And I know my mother and father did. I appreciated that. And that's enough to keep you going, just to know that somebody is dependent upon you and you do your best.
So you were there the day the war began. You saw firsthand the devastation. When you finally heard the war was over, when Japan surrendered, was that significant for you?
Yes, it was, but we were expecting that to happen, but it was a great... I was in Australia, and they celebrated in the streets for over a week, and I went along with them. I was happy, too. I was glad it was over. I was eager to get on with life. I'm thankful that I survived it. I'm thankful for my wife. I'm thankful for my life, and I thank the Lord for it.
Bill Pratt, one of four brothers to serve in World War II, two of them survived December 7th, 1941, aboard the battleship USS Nevada. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a man who survived the sinking of the USS Oklahoma at Pearl Harbor 81 years ago, Hometown Heroes, will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, preparing you for Wednesday's 81st anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The USS Arizona famously lost 1,177 men on December 7, 1941. But after the Arizona, the most losses came on the battleship USS Oklahoma, 429. George Coburn is one of the last survivors who can tell the Oklahoma story.
That morning, while I was in the plotting room, I heard the public address system was keyed open, and I could hear a hiss and a little background noise, and then this voice came up and said, all hands, man your battle stations. And then he came back and said, real planes, real bombs, no sh**. And he, it was an officer who said that, and later he explained that he knew that enlisted men used no sh** as an exclamation and to emphasize a point, and he wanted to emphasize the real planes, real bombs, but it worked backward, because I heard that and I thought, geez, that doesn't belong on a public address system. This must be a bogus announcement total. And I went over to the next compartment. There was an electrician there, and I asked him what he thought about it. And he says, some drunk probably got back from Liberty and found a access to the PA system, decided he'd have a little fun. And then a more authoritative voice came up on the PA system and made the standard call to battle stations and also set off the general alarm. And so I started for my battle station. I made a detour to go to the shop and get a shirt out of my locker, because you didn't go topside without a shirt in those days. And my battle station was in an anti-aircraft director, and so I had a lot of climbing to do to get up there. And the Navy had a rule for everything, and traffic control was you move forward and up on the starboard side and aft and down on the port side. But they had another rule, and that was in the event of an air raid, all unengaged personnel go below the second deck, which was an armored deck. So I got to the up ladder, and they were sending people down, and I couldn't get up. I never got to my battle station. And when the last man cleared the hatch, they slammed it down and dogged it down tight from up above. And so there were probably, I don't know, about 20 men in this little area where the ladder, they were all people who had topside battle stations, and of course nobody got there. The first torpedo hit, and the deck jumped, and it was a little bit more of a shock than when the main battery went off, but we weren't unaccustomed to explosions because we had gunnery practice fairly often. And anyway, the lights went out, and more torpedoes hit the ship. I've heard all kinds of numbers on how many there were, and I didn't try to count them, so I can't argue with them.
Is that the first time that it was really real to you, though, when you felt the impact of that first torpedo? Is that when you first knew that this was real and this was war?
Yeah, I would guess that was probably the beginning of realization that we got a problem here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened was a source of oil got ruptured, and we got sprayed with fuel oil, and the deck got covered with fuel oil. And because of that, and the ship was beginning to list, people couldn't stand up. And it wound up that a pool of oil formed against the low side bulkhead, and men were slipping into that pool and just wallowing around in oil down there. I've thought many times, if they just thought about it, they have figured out how to get the heck out of there, but they didn't. As far as I know, they probably perished right there.
Because they drowned in the pool of oil?
Well, because they couldn't get out of the ship because they were stuck in this pool. And
And again, this is in the dark as well. The lights are out. Can you see anything?
I could see a little because somebody showed up with a flashlight, and that was a big help. It helped the guys that were up on the ladder and trying to get the hatch open. It helped them a lot because they were using their fists and or anything they could find to try to hammer the dogs from their tight position. And well, they finally got it open. And everybody rushed for the ladder, and the darn thing broke. I don't know just what happened, but either some fitting came loose or the pin that secured the top of the ladder sheared, because had a lot of men on the ladder, and the deck was over maybe 45 degrees by then, and oil on the deck didn't help the ladder stay in position either, so it just twisted. And somebody had the good sense to yell, "Everybody get the hell off the ladder or nobody will get out of here. It'll break." And so the people complied with that. And then we went up one by one. And I don't know whether everybody got out or not, but we got up to the second deck and then on up to the main deck. And there was probably 10 of us together at that time, and I looked back, the normal exit from the ship would be out onto the quarter deck, and that was about maybe 100 feet away. There was a big group of men back there. It didn't appear to be moving, and besides, there was all kinds of gear and lockers and bunks and everything that was loose or jarred loose by the explosions had slid down against the bulkhead, and we would have had to crawl or make our way over that stuff in order to get back to the weather deck. I saw an open porthole. Shouldn't have been open. We were at general quarters. If it had been closed, I probably wouldn't even thought of trying to get out of porthole. But I decided that's for me. I went, crawled up across whatever was available to get a handhold on, and a few fellas followed me. Some of them went and started going back to the weather deck. And anyway, six of us got out of that porthole. And at the time, the side of the ship was easy to stand on because ship had rolled over far enough to where it wasn't level yet, but it was close to it. And some of the things I should have mentioned. When we were down in the fourth deck and torpedoes were hitting, and we had the light from a flashlight, but no more. Some of the guys were yelling, and some were cursing, and some were praying. And I'll always remember one voice that called for Mama to come and help. He called repeatedly, "Mama, come and help me." And he was in the pool of oil. And
well, what about you? I mean, you're describing this. I know you're a 22-year-old young man at the time. You didn't know this was going to happen. This came completely out of the blue. I mean, it sounds absolutely terrifying. Did you feel that fear? Was there panic? How did you handle it?
I didn't feel any fear or panic, but I think I was in shock. It isn't hard to remember, because I'll remember this most hours forever. I don't know.
And I know there are a lot of other details here, but if you hadn't seen that open porthole, what do you think would have happened to you?
I probably would have died in the ship. Linda has told me repeatedly says, "You're both lucky and smart." She said, you made a lot of good decisions to get out of the ship, and you also were lucky to have the avenues available to get out. And I have to agree that those two things were big factors.
Well, and reading some of what you two have been working on, I noted the story about the chaplain and that porthole.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wasn't there. A different porthole. We had a lot of portholes.
Yeah.
And anyway, the chaplain, he wasn't a heavy man. His bony structure was such that he had wide hips, and he wouldn't fit through the porthole. I tried to drag him through, and it just wouldn't work. And he stood back and helped push other fellas through. And undoubtedly, by then, he knew that his life was going to end shortly. And but it took courage to behave the way he did and to do something that helped somebody. He couldn't help himself, but he could help somebody else, and he did it.
Is he someone you'd been familiar with on the ship, or no?
Well, I knew the chaplain because his office was right next to the fire control sleeping compartment, and so I would see him frequently. And I certainly knew who he was and what his job was and et cetera. But I was never a church-going guy, so I didn't really know the chaplain.
Well, here's a little that we do know about that chaplain, and I have this linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. His name was Aloysius Schmidt. He was a 32-year-old Catholic priest from Iowa, and he had just celebrated Mass aboard the Oklahoma when that first torpedo struck. Survivors' accounts say that Father Schmidt helped as many as 12 sailors through that porthole that he himself could not squeeze through. In 1942, he was posthumously awarded the Non-Combat Navy and Marine Corps Medal, but that award has since been upgraded. In 2016, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency was able to identify his remains and finally return him home to Iowa. The publicity around that story produced newfound interest in Father Schmidt's heroism on December 7th. And in 2017, in Dubuque, Iowa, at his alma mater, Loras College, Schmidt's family was presented by the Navy's Chief of Chaplains with the Silver Star. The citation reading, "With unselfish disregard for his own plight, he assisted his shipmates through the aperture. When they in turn were in the process of rescuing him, his body became tightly wedged in the narrow opening. Realizing that other men had come into the compartment seeking a way out," the citation continues about Father Al, as he was known, "he insisted he be pushed back into the ship so that others might escape. Calmly urging them on with his blessing, he remained behind while his shipmates crawled out to safety. In so doing, he gallantly gave up his life for his country." Aloysius Schmidt, one of the more than 2,400 Americans who lost their lives on Oahu on that day of infamy. And what was that scene from your vantage point, George? What did you see when you finally got out of that porthole?
I saw a lot of smoke and fire, and I saw airplanes buzzing around, and I heard the zing of ricocheting bullets, and because they kept making passes down the battleship row and strafing. I slid down the side the bottom of the ship, actually, and into the water, and kicked off my shoes in order to swim better. And the ship was tied up to the Maryland, and as it turned over, the space between the two ships widened and was maybe 60, 75 feet wide by the time I got in the water. And the ropes that had tied two ships together parted as Oklahoma rolled over, and some of them were still hanging into the water. And each of those had a dozen men trying to climb up, and nobody could make any progress because it just too many. And they were like a bunch of bananas. Me and other fellows yelled at people who looked over the side of the mirror and throw down some more ropes so we can come aboard. And eventually somebody did, and I got aboard the Maryland and was put to work immediately handling ammunition to a 3-inch 50 anti-aircraft gun, which I might say was one of the most useless weapons the Navy had. The probability of hitting an airplane with that gun was somewhat below zero.
It's like trying to hit a butterfly with a bazooka or something?
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned because your ship has rolled over so far, you're actually sliding down the bottom of the ship into the water. And was that water on fire? Was it oily? What were you dealing with there?
Well, it was foul because we didn't have a tank aboard ship to store sewage until we were far at sea. It went right into the bay. So Pearl Harbor was probably some of the most polluted water in the world.
And are there still bullets flying while you're in the water trying to get a rope?
Well, the Arizona blew up while I was in the water, and that was a magnificent explosion. The ball of fire rolled up and didn't dissipate right away. It just kept rising, and Arizona released a lot of fuel oil, and it was on the surface of the water, and the wind was blowing it toward us. It was on fire. That didn't worry me because I was a good swimmer, and I figured I can swim faster than that's coming. But anyway, I did get go aboard to Maryland, and was kind of disheartening, you know. Had just lost my home and probably some good friends, all of my personal belongings. The only thing I had was what I happened to have in my pocket when I left the ship. That happened to be a little screwdriver about 3 inches long. So, wasn't much utility in that.
You know, here you've been through all this, but you get aboard the Maryland, and there's still a battle going on. So they throw you right into work passing the ammunition.
The Maryland got hit by a bomb while I was aboard. I understand the damage wasn't really bad, but it wouldn't take long, but they moved all of us from the Oklahoma over onto Ford Island and mustered us and began trying to find out who made it out and who didn't. And from there, they moved us on over to Westlock, which was an ammunition depot, and we went to work replenishing ammunition to make up for what had been expended during the raid. One of the ships that came in, it was a destroyer that had been on offshore patrol and had sunk a midget submarine. They came in for depth charges, and a bunch of angry sailors, because what I heard from them was that the ship had sent in to headquarters in Pearl Harbor that they had sunk a submarine in a restricted area. I call it restricted area because they had this area outside, out in the open ocean, where a submarine was not allowed to proceed submerged unless they had a surface escort. So the destroyer, I think the name was Ward, the thing that they were incensed about was they sent the word in and they got a return message that said, "Verify the report they sent back to Pearl Harbor. Verify hell, we're sinking another one right now." So exactly how that exchange went, I don't know, but that's what I got from the crew.
And the implication is that people, well, ships like yours could have been on alert as opposed to caught off guard if that had been communicated correctly.
I don't know that it would have done a whole lot of good. Getting a ship underway and clearing the harbor, I don't think we had time to do it.
So there were 429 who died aboard the Oklahoma that day. Did it set in immediately for you that certain guys were lost, or was there an uncertainty for a while you're trying to figure out which ones of your friends made it and who didn't?
It took me a long time to figure that out because information, well, there was a lot of information running around and being repeated here, there, and everywhere, but you never knew whether it was bogus or whether it was real. And so as a result, nobody felt well informed.
Are there some people that you knew well that you still reflect on every once in a while that were killed that day?
Yes. Yeah. There was later during the war, we had a beer bus once in a while on one of the South Pacific islands. We didn't have any of those grass-skirted girls, but anyway, I met a fellow who told me about one of the fire patrolmen that he saw before he got out of the ship. And I won't mention the guy's name because he might have family still wondering. But anyway, he saw this fellow, a red-headed kid. He was down at the low side of the ship and wallowing around in a flooded area and apparently confused to the degree where he couldn't make any real progress. And I always wondered what happened to that guy. He wasn't a close friend. I didn't know him well, but he was in my division and an acquaintance. But then I looked in the book Battleship Oklahoma, and there's a list of the entire crew and who survived and who didn't, and after this kid's name was missing in action. He didn't make it.
Well, and there are quite a few whose remains were never identified, and just in the last couple of years, they've started to identify more of those and return them home.
Using DNA to identify them. They get family samples and are able to pretty well lock in the identity that way.
Well, and another thing that was fairly unique about the Oklahoma is because it capsized, there were still some pockets of air, and there were guys trapped inside for a day and a half. Were you guys aware at the time? Did you hear about the crews that were working to try to rescue them?
Yes. Yeah, we heard about them. Mm-hmm. In fact, I saw some of the activity. It had already started while I was still aboard the Maryland, and they really got on it promptly, and of course they were able to save 30-some-odd men, and too bad they couldn't get more. But
well, and that's what I was curious about, because here, this is your ship, and this has been such a devastating situation. I mean, it devastated the whole country. But to have that rescue a day and a half later, was that a shot in the arm?
Somewhat, yeah. Although, by then, I was over in Westlock handling ammunition. I had no real first-hand news. You know, there were all kinds of stories running around. I mean, we were going to be invaded, and let's say sailors have a good imagination. If they didn't have a story, they made one up.
Was there a moment for you where the magnitude of the whole situation sank in, where you could fathom how much had been destroyed and how devastating it was?
There actually was a moment like that. But it wasn't in proximity to the actual happening. It was decades later. In fact, it was fairly recent. I've thought about that morning many times, but this one time it seemed real again. And I thought, dang, there's something missing here. And later I wrote that the thing that was missing might be the emotional devastation that we suffered. I wrote, we lost our home, probably some good friends, all of our personal belongings, and our magnificent fleet was rapidly being turned into junk. I really felt the impact of of that morning more strongly at that time than I did while I was experiencing it.
Well, and you know, I threw out that number 429, and the only ship that lost more that morning was the Arizona, of course. But what about your family back here in San Diego? I'm sure they're hearing it on the radio that Pearl Harbor has been attacked. They know that's where you are. What did they experience?
You know, the Salvation Army, some ladies came by when I was at Westlock, and they gave us postcards and already stamped and pencils. And so I wrote on the postcard and put it in the mail, and I was lucky enough to get home in January, and I walked in the door, and they thought I was a ghost. The postcard hadn't arrived, and it didn't arrive for several more weeks.
So your mother had presumed, because of the news reports, that you had died.
That's what they thought, yeah. They thought that I'd gone down with the ship like so many others did.
But then you walked in the door.
Yeah.
So what was the look on your mother's face?
Astonishment, and probably mixed with relief and et cetera. But I don't know. Primarily it was astonishment.
And you naturally had assumed that they'd received the postcard, right?
Yes, I had assumed that. And otherwise I might have tried to make some kind of pre-entry contact. But I just walked in the door like I'd been across the street talking to Charlie.
That must have caught you off guard to see your mother's reaction.
Well, yes, it did. It surprised me. By that time, I'd had enough recent surprises, though, that didn't have any problem with it.
That was USS Oklahoma survivor George Coburn. We're not done yet with this special edition of Hometown Heroes. When we come back, a man who was wounded three times during World War II, all after he survived December 7th, 1941 on the island of Oahu. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton. With experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
That, of course, is the most famous speech President Franklin D. Roosevelt ever gave, addressing the nation on December 8, 1941. A close second would be his radio address from June 6, 1944, a lengthy prayer for those participating in D-Day that was heard over airwaves just like this all those years ago. And now, that prayer is soon to be immortalized in bronze in Washington, D.C. Just this past week, the words of that prayer were cast in a bronze plaque by Matthews International of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Soon that plaque will be installed at the National World War II Memorial. We've heard that prayer a few times on this program, and I do have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. When I FaceTimed earlier this week with 102-year-old Frank Paredes, he asked me if he could go back to Washington. He had such a memorable trip there with Central Valley Honor Flight 8 years ago. Soon, all the honor flights from around the country will have a chance to read FDR's words there at the memorial. And I want you to listen to some of Frank Paredes' words right now. He was one of four brothers to serve in World War II, but one of 16 children growing up in Arizona in a family with Mescalero Apache heritage. Frank had already worked in copper mines and crewed a tuna fishing boat off the coast of South America before joining the Army a month after his 20th birthday.
That was in September the 16th of 1941. I had to find something for me to do, something to be helpful. So that's what I did. I joined the military. They sent me to Hawaii. I was on my way to Manila to join the troops in Manila. So I was waiting in Pearl Harbor, Schofield Barracks actually, on a cadre to go, waiting for more people to show up to go to Manila. But that's when I got caught, you know. Incidentally, a friend of mine, his name was Max Druin. He went in the Navy and I went in the Army. He was aboard the USS West Virginia. I was in Schofield Barracks, so on Saturday night, December the 6th, I went to Pearl Harbor to visit with him, and we had a few beers, you know, and chatted, you know, about the hometown and this and that. I told Max, I says, I got to catch the last shuttle to Schofield Barracks, otherwise I'll be stranded here, you know, and I do help the priest say Mass on Sunday mornings. So I caught my shuttle, went back, and I made it okay. 8 o'clock, about 5 minutes to eight, I was on my way to church for Mass. And all of a sudden, I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off. And they says, this is not a drill. This is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's when everything went haywire. So I started picking up, fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. And then I got on, they put me on a ship, and I was on my way to Australia.
Well, let me come back to that, because you described it, and I know you lived it, and you probably tell these stories a few times. But you're a 21-year-old kid, you're on your way to Mass, and all of a sudden, World War II begins for America. And you're right there in the thick of it, and you hop on a machine gun and shoot a Japanese plane. What did this feel like? Because I imagine that's a pretty big shock to your system, that all of a sudden you're at war, and the world is crazy. How did you deal with that?
I know it was crazy. So I joined the military for one thing and one thing only, to do what I had to do for my country. And that's what I did.
Was it scary for you in that moment? I mean, this is day one. I mean, you knew maybe something was going to happen at some point, but now it's actually here right in your face.
Yeah, it was scary. But the way I figured, you live at one day at a time. And that's the way it went, you know, all through my military life.
And you said you were helping out for 7 or 8 days in the aftermath of the Japanese attack. And there aren't a whole lot of people left with us anymore that actually saw those things with their own two eyes. What are some of the things that you saw and experienced in those days following the attack that you still remember today, that in when you close your eyes, you can still picture exactly what that looked like?
Well, to me, you know, I still have dreams about that. And those dreams, you know, make you... Well, to me, they make you go on and on, live your life as you want to live it.
Were you
around Schofield Barracks cleaning up, or did you go down to the harbor and help with pulling bodies out of the water and all that?
Yes, I went to, I started pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
And I know there are other moments, because this is just the start of the war and you were in for a while, but when you think back specifically about December 7th, is there part of you that says, yeah, I could have been one of those more than 2,000 that died there?
Yes, I lost a few friends. I lost, especially in Schofield Barracks, I lost a few friends there. And then aboard the USS Arizona, I lost a cousin. His name was William Webb. So when I went back to Pearl Harbor in 1990, I went to the memorial, and there was Japanese people going to the USS Arizona, and they were speaking in Japanese, and they were descendants of the pilots that had bombed Pearl Harbor because, you know, I had a lot of Japanese friends here before the war. And I learned a little bit about Japanese, you know. I could understand some of it, but not all of it. But they had, you know, people there too, you know, wanted to go see the memorial. And then the memorial, you could still see oil coming out. And I think that'll go on forever because there's a lot of people that are buried there, you know, underwater.
Is your cousin one of them?
Yes.
And at the time, back in 1941, I'm sure there was some uncertainty at first. You guys didn't know who had survived, who hadn't. When did you find out that your cousin had died, and what did that do to you?
I found out that when after the war, I went to my cousin's, you know, to his mom, you know. Her name was Clotilde. She says, I'm very proud of my son. He died a hero. Anyway, that's about all I can remember about him, you know. But getting back to picking up bodies, parts of bodies, taking them, you know, to grave registration, it took a while, you know, to get everything, you know, squared away.
And I know you'd been exposed to a lot through working in the mines and doing your tuna trip to South America and all that. So you'd seen a lot and experienced a lot, but I can't imagine that being easy to see this death and destruction all around you. How did you cope with that? How did you deal with it at the time?
Well, you have to deal with whatever comes along. You have to deal with it, you know, one way or the other. Some people, as a rule, you know, deals like what I went through, they'd go bananas. But I kept my wits, you know, and I'm doing fine as of now, you know, and I'm still doing great.
What's the secret? How do you do that?
You would have to ask me that. I think it's my Indian heritage. As I was growing up, I did a lot of things what the Indians did.
When I talk to guys who are at Pearl Harbor, and I talk to guys who just served in the war, period, remember Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was three words that seemed to hold a lot of weight for them. For you, as you go on, and we're going to hear some of your adventures in the rest of the war, how big of a motivation was what you had seen and experienced at Pearl Harbor? What did remember Pearl Harbor mean to you?
It meant to me that remember Pearl Harbor, keep on going and give them hell. And that's what we did.
Indeed, they did. And Frank still attacks life with that same spirit at age 102. As we approach yet another anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, I'm reminded of so many Pearl Harbor survivors we've had the privilege of meeting on Hometown Heroes who are no longer here to tell their stories. But the reason so many of them told those stories so diligently for so long is encapsulated in the motto of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. Remember Pearl Harbor, keep America alert. That eternal vigilance they advocate is underscored by the sacrifice of more than 2,400 Americans around the island of Oahu on that day of infamy. Another powerful reminder that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.